Please join me, if you will, in welcoming our keynote speaker for the morning, Laura Dawson Ulrich. Ms. Ulrich is a senior regional economist for the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. She holds a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Georgia and a master and doctorate degrees in economics from the University of Tennessee. Ms. Ulrich was previously the dean of undergraduate studies and an economics professor at Winthrop University. Please join me in welcoming Laura Dawson Ulrich.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Good morning. This is a great crowd, a big crowd. Happy to be here to bring mostly good news about what's going on in the economy. So I am Laura Dawson Ulrich. I am the regional economist for the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. My office is in Charlotte, but I've been a resident of Rock Hill, South Carolina for 17 years now. So South Carolina feels like home at this point for sure. So I was really excited about coming to this talk today. My job as the regional economist is really to be out in communities every day, kind of boots on the ground economists, finding out what's going on in the economy in real time. So that might be talking to a bank CEO one day, a farmer the following day, and then visiting a technical college the third day. So all over both states, which is really my favorite part of my job. So before I get started, I always get to remind people that the views I'm going to express are mine alone and don't represent an official position of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond or the Federal Reserve System. All right, got that out of the way. Okay, where are we now? So 2023 was incredibly interesting for economists like myself. This time last year, and especially at the end of 2022, looking forward into 2023, it looked like we were going to kind of have a flat year of growth. There were models that were predicting a recession. There were models that weren't. I was telling people at the time that I did not see us going into a recession, and people looked at me very skeptically when I said that. But I was kind of expecting about flat growth in 2023. That's what most of the models showed. That is not what we had at all. We actually ended the year with relatively strong economic growth, especially in the third and fourth quarters. So because of that, fears of an immediate recession have sort of lessened. Now, as our president, Tom Barkin, likes to say, the fact that we're not going to go into recession tomorrow doesn't mean somebody has canceled the business cycle. At some point in time, we will have a recession. That we know that. The question is just when. And oftentimes, recessions come most of the time from a shock that you're not expecting. So I'm going to stand up here today and tell you that none of the data that I look at on a daily basis looks like we're about to have a recession. I could wake up tomorrow and something could be completely different. Okay. But right now, things look pretty good, especially in places like South Carolina, and I'll show you more of this data. And really, this is driven by consumer spending. The consumer has been incredibly resilient, especially when you consider the inflationary pressures that we've had and the cumulative inflation, right? So if you look at the price differences now compared to 2020, there's a pretty big difference, right? And so the fact that real consumer spending, and I'll show all of this to you in charts, but real consumer spending, so the amount people spend after controlling for inflation has continued to climb, is pretty incredible. The pace of job growth continues to just be staggering, in my opinion. We got a jobs announcement on Friday that was well above economists' expectations. And I will tell you that while some of the firms we talk to have slowed down their hiring a bit, most of the firms we talk to every day still are still hiring and still plan to continue to hire. I do want to point out, though, that in our area, there are some metro areas, so Charlotte, Raleigh, Charleston, that are far outperforming the rest of the area, rest of even urban areas and especially rural areas in terms of economic and population growth. It is very important for me as an economist to acknowledge that while places like Charleston and Raleigh are literally on fire in terms of growth, that half of the counties in South Carolina and North Carolina are experiencing population declines and employment declines. So while some of you are in places and your feet are planted most every day in places that feel very bright, vibrant, there's exciting economic development announcements, I also was in Eastern North Carolina last week in some places that haven't seen an economic announcement in decades. So things are different depending on where your feet are planted, and that's important to recognize. And that's going to continue to be the case. And a lot of this is based on geography. A lot of it is based on industry. And so, unfortunately, there continue to kind of be winning communities and losing communities. Inflation is still above the Fed's 2% average target, but it is certainly moving in the right direction. And it's moving in the right direction faster than we might have expected, given the strength of consumption, consumer spending, and hiring. And I'll show you all of this. The FOMC just met, decided to hold rates firm. People are very eagerly anticipating this first rate cut. I don't know if any of you guys saw Jerome Powell on 60 Minutes or read some of his statements or the other president's statements. And if you look at their projections in 2024, they certainly aren't anticipating rates being cut at some point this year, but just not yet. So I will say, you also have to remember that these really strong jobs reports, in economic theory anyway, that goes against lowering inflation, right? That's demand going out even more, so prices, all else equal, would go up. And so that's why sometimes you're going to see economists be a little hesitant about this, right? Like, do we know inflation is really coming down to this 2% target? Is this last mile going to be harder than the first 10 miles? We'll see. So still some uncertainty out there. But this is GDP. This is real GDP. So as a reminder from Econ 101, GDP is the total value of all final goods and services produced in the United States in a given year. And the fact that this is real GDP means we are holding prices constant, which means we're valuing all the stuff, goods and services, that is produced in a given year. And you can see that really, I mean, the COVID period was just unreal from an economic point of view. Largest one quarter decline in history in GDP, largest one quarter increase in history in GDP. But since then, except for the first two quarters of 2022, we have seen pretty strong economic growth. And you heard me mention at the beginning that really these last quarters, Q3 and Q4 of 2023, were incredibly strong. For a country like the United States, really anything above about 2% growth is pretty tough to achieve. And the reason for that is, if you think about how you make more stuff, right? So this real GDP is the value of all the goods and services we're producing in the U.S. How do you produce more? You either need more people producing, or you need to get more efficient and have greater productivity, right? The same number of people can produce more. And so if you kind of simplify economic growth, you can really think of it as population growth plus productivity growth. Our population growth is extraordinarily small in the U.S., low as in the United States as a whole, but in places like South Carolina, it's pretty strong, right? South Carolina is the fastest growing state in the country last year. So in a place like South Carolina, easier to grow a little faster than you'll see at the U.S. level as a whole. So when we're seeing things like, you know, the Q3 growth came in at 3.3%, growth for 2023 as a whole is going to exceed 3%, it's probably going to be 3.1, 3.2 when the final numbers come out. That's strong economic growth. So really different than about a quarter or half the models that were predicting recession this year. So what is this about? It is about this graph. It is about consumption. This top line, this is real consumption expenditures. So once again, controls for inflation. So the way I like to describe this to people who don't know a lot about economics is you can think about this as how much, like you can think about this kind of like as a grocery cart, and how much are people putting in their cart? How many goods, how many services are they buying? Now, if you told me as an economist 5 years ago, we're going to hit 9.1% max inflation, which is what we hit two summers ago, and real consumer spending is going to continue to climb, I would have told you that was impossible. Because all else equal, if prices go up that much, people got to put less in their cart. What I wouldn't have known in that basic scenario is what happened during the COVID era. There were two major effects that have allowed consumption to continue to climb. The first is the significant decrease you see in consumption. And by the way, the top line is total consumption, middle line is services, and bottom line is goods. And what you'll see is that consumption took a huge hit in March and April 2020. Why is that? It's a combination of fear. People have a natural response when we don't know what's going on to pull back. But then also some of the things we spent money on, all of a sudden you could not spend money on anymore. So some of the things that, maybe you spent money typically on daycare and the daycare center closed. Or maybe you got to eat a lot at restaurants and that wasn't available to you anymore. My household, we had saved a long time to go on a trip to Europe. We were supposed to leave April 3rd. And I remember every day waking up and it was just eroding, like we're not going. But people were kind and everybody gave us our money back for that trip. So all of a sudden we have this money that we wouldn't have had just sitting around, right? So people had what we call excess savings. And they saved those and are now spending that down. And for the vast majority of households, that money is spent down at this point. But also, the other thing that we cannot overlook is the amount of stimulus that came into the economy. And when I say stimulus, people immediately jump to stimulus checks, and there were stimulus checks that went to low, moderate income households. But that's actually a very small percentage of the overall stimulus. So when I say stimulus, I'm talking PPP loans, I'm talking HERF dollars for higher ed, ESSER dollars for K-12 districts, the money that hospitals got, the money that state and local governments got. Really, there were many institutions that had kind of once-in-a-lifetime funding flow through them. In addition to that, we had the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, the Infrastructure Act, right? All of this legislation. Now, research is going to tell us in the end whether or not that was a good idea to throw all that money into the economy. I think what's interesting is that, and I'll get to inflation in a minute, but it has been unclear if inflation has been more of a demand effect or supply effect. I'll talk about that. Because certainly all that stimulus increased demand. So it played a role in inflation, but it also is likely what kept us out of a recession in the long run. So economic research will tell us kind of how that plays out in the end. But I think that's certainly what's happened. And you'll see here that goods and services spending was impacted differently. Services spending was impacted the most significantly right away. Goods pulled back a little bit, but then goods exploded. The demand for goods went up. And this is actually what we saw first, was goods-based inflation. Demand for goods went up, supply for goods went down. All of us at that period of time, if you go back, I will never forget the day my three teenage boys came home with me for the next year and a half. That was March 13th, Friday the 13th. And I love my boys, but I had one in elementary, one in middle, one in high school at the time, three different online platforms for their schools. And a job I was supposed to do, right? And so the goods I wanted to buy were doors because I have an open floor plan house that I just loved my open floor plan house. And when these three boys came home, I was like, if I don't build an office for myself right now, someone's not going to make it. Like, and I don't want it to be me, not be me. So I wanted to buy doors. Well, guess what? Demand for doors was really high. I was not the only person trapped at home with their children. So demand was really high and supply was low because some of the doors that were supposed to come from China or wherever else didn't come. So what do you think the price was like for doors? Sky high. And I paid for them happily with that money we were supposed to go on vacation for. I bought them because I wanted them so bad. Everybody in this room bought something in that mid to late March, early April time period that you probably wouldn't have bought if not for what happened. And so you can see that here. Goods purchases have still remained really high. People are buying stuff. Services has just now caught up. And so now some of the inflation we're seeing, and I'll show you this data later, is more services-based inflation. But here's the good news. And I actually think, and these are just my thoughts, once again, not the Fed's thoughts, my thoughts. Inflation can occur because of two things. So if you think about like a supply and demand chart, inflation can occur because demand goes up, prices go up, right? Demand for Taylor Swift tickets goes up, price of the tickets goes up, right? We all know that. And that did happen during COVID because of people having excess savings and the stimulus that I mentioned. But prices can also go up because supply goes down. Those are sometimes called supply shocks. And during COVID, we had both of these things. We had a significant supply shock. The first time I ever heard of COVID, which was called the coronavirus then, was in a meeting with a manufacturer in South Carolina who had an input for his products that were produced in the Wuhan province in China. And he said, you know, there's some virus going on there that has shut down the factory, right? So actually these supply things were really what kind of started happening in the very beginning before the virus even got here, right, from China. And so what we saw was this just outrageous increase in what we call the supply chain pressure index. That has normalized. This is really good news for a couple of reasons, one of which is the Federal Reserve's actions are unlikely to impact supply chain very much. This is driven by all sorts of global issues, price of oil, things that the Federal Reserve's changing interest rates is not going to impact a whole lot. I think, and once again, we got to wait like a couple years for all the research to come out on this. But I think the fact that inflation coming down as fast as it has, with demand staying so strong from consumers, maybe shows that inflation was more of a supply effect, that this supply shock actually raised prices more than the demand. We'll have to see. But I think this supply chain normalizing, it's now cheaper to get a ship from China to the United States than it was before COVID. There are still random shortages out there, but for the most part, that has calmed down. This is really good news. So this is employment. You know, I mentioned that we keep getting these very strong month-over-month numbers. The January numbers came out. Oh, that should say January 24, too. Just found a typo. Those numbers came out Friday, 353,000 jobs. To level set that number for you, we need to add about 80 to 100,000 jobs a month to keep up with population growth and churn in the labor force. So anything over 100, you can think of as the economy expanding. Anything under 80, you could think of as kind of a contraction in the economy. So 353,000 jobs is a lot of jobs. In December, 333,000 jobs. And if you look, we have added over 100,000 jobs every single month since COVID took that initial decline. Now, we are not back nationally to where we would have been if COVID had never happened. That is that light blue dotted line. And one thing I want to point out to you is that this is very typical of a recession. So if you look back here at the Great Recession, if you were to draw the employment line there, it would be somewhere like this. We never got back to where employment would have been before if we had, you know, assumed the recession had ever happened. These recessions can have very long lasting, very long kind of tentacles of impact. And so we're not back to where we were before, but we are well above our pre-COVID employment in the United States. The same thing is true for South Carolina. Now, I will point out to you that South Carolina, if you go back before the Great Recession, is higher than you would have predicted. Okay, so there are certain places that have done very well. South Carolina is one of them. I will point out to you, though, that North Carolina is pretty good ways above where we would have predicted if COVID had never happened. So there are a few states, Florida, Texas, Idaho, North Carolina, that are above projected employment pre-COVID. But South Carolina is close. And in my in the 5th District of the Federal Reserve Bank, the Richmond Fed, our geography that we cover is the Carolinas, Virginia, Maryland, West Virginia, D.C. So these are all the geographies in our area. And what we did here is we indexed employment to 100 in February 2020 so we can see how many jobs were lost and then what has the path back looked like. And you can see here that the Carolinas are big time outliers in our geography. We still have three places, Washington, D.C., West Virginia, and Maryland, that are below pre-COVID employment. I had the opportunity two Mondays ago, to be in Annapolis, Maryland, doing a presentation. I do a lot of research on community and technical colleges, and I was there speaking about that research. And in Maryland, they are having to have very serious state-level conversations about a declining budget because their revenues are falling, because they're losing population, they're losing talent to states like North and South Carolina. Very different conversation. Being in that place felt very different than the conversations I'm normally in the Carolinas. I joke with the economists. We have an economist that covers Maryland and West Virginia. And one time I asked him, do you use this chart in your presentations? He was like, no, we look awful. I'm like, oh, I always use it. Because he's like, yeah, you look great. But I do like to point out to people, though, that it can feel very different depending on where you are right now. There are places in the U.S. where things do not feel as strong. This shows some of that same data, but this is by sector. And what I want to point out to you here is you'll see North Carolina is green. South Carolina is kind of this yellowish color. And this is employment growth or contraction by sector. And the darkest blue on the left-hand side is D.C. Maryland is kind of a dark green color. But what you'll see is sector over sector. North Carolina and South Carolina are kind of leading the way with just a very few exceptions like natural resources, where West Virginia is very strong. And you'll see those other states are kind of consistently on the negative side. I will point out, you know, I mentioned North Carolina has grown a bit faster in South Carolina. It is really right here, this professional and business services. This is a huge sector in both states, and North Carolina has gotten a ton of professional and business services sector job. These are anything from accountants to architects to and people that work in their offices too, right? These are like kind of traditional office jobs, and that sector has really grown in South Carolina as well, but especially North Carolina. And this is a lot about where people want to live. You know, there are many things about the Carolinas that are highly attractive, that are things that make me feel like these two states will continue to be on the winning side of the coin because there are things that aren't going to change, right? And it is the weather. It is the distance to the beach and the mountains, which you hear people say all the time, but it really is true. It's these things that, you know, quality of life that people value. And I think people value even more now, kind of post-COVID, than they did before. Oh, no. I don't know what happened here. So this thing that you can't see shows the growth rates by MSA. And let me just summarize it for you. I wish I knew the exact numbers off the top of my head. I'll make sure they have corrected one of these to give to you. But Charleston MSA, the Charleston MSA, so Berkeley, Dorchester, Charleston counties, is outpacing growth everywhere else in the state to a pretty big degree, with the exception of Myrtle Beach MSA, so you're where you live. So those two MSAs have grown much faster than the other places in South Carolina in terms of employment. And one of the things I wanted to point out here was population growth doesn't always equal employment growth. So Hilton Head MSA, for example, you would see has very strong population growth, but their employment growth is not very strong because many people who are moving to the MSA are moving there with the intentional purpose to not work, right? That's why they're moving there. And so when you talk to people there, there's a real labor shortage going on, right? Because when retirees move in, we like for them to move in. They spend a lot of money, but they also require a lot of health care. They require a lot of other services. And as many of you know, they're very opinionated about the services that you offer them. So it requires more employment, and not everywhere is getting that employment. So, and as I mentioned, the rural counties, in many cases, their talent is leaving. One of the really interesting patterns that we've seen over the past few years, and this really is why places like North and South Carolina are doing so well, is that people have left the largest metro areas to move places like Greenville, South Carolina, or Charleston, South Carolina. So New York, D.C., San Francisco, all these big metro areas, which became very difficult to live in when people wanted to distance a bit more. And once people could work remotely, potentially, or had that opportunity, it's really expensive to live in those places, right? But what we've also seen is that people have moved from more rural places to those same types of metros. So you basically have a place like Greenville, South Carolina, getting big city folks and smaller town folks coming in. And another thing we're seeing is that it's becoming more common for people to commute in from some of these rural places, and so they continue to lose employment. So labor force participation, this is actually kind of the type of research I spend most of my time with as an economist is kind of these labor force patterns, what's going on in the workforce. I think there are some incredibly interesting things going on in labor. I think this is the story for the rest of my career in the economy. And I get asked a lot, like, where are all the workers? What's going on? Well, I just told you that we have more jobs in the United States than we've ever had. We have more people working than we've ever had. And we have a labor shortage. This can happen simultaneously, but it seems a little odd. But let me tell you the story. So this is labor force participation. Labor force participation rate is the percentage of adults who are either working or actively seeking a job. Okay, so either working or submitting resumes, interviewing, those types of things. And I like to go all the way back to post-World War II when I show this graph, because I actually think some of the labor forces we're feeling are pretty similar to post-World War II. Post-World War II, we had very strong demand for goods and services. People wanted to spend money. They were spending money, but we had a labor shortage. And at the time, we had a labor shortage really for two reasons. Number one, people came back from the war, and many of them went to college on the GI Bill. So some people didn't go right back into the workforce. You had people that were disabled who died, right? And women didn't work very much. So we had a tight labor market then, and this is really one of the periods of time in U.S. history where, like, labor unions got much stronger and companies had to really work to hire new people, diversify their workforce and things like this, because it was hard to hire. But then what happened between the 1960s and the 1990s? Well, there were two reasons we had this really extreme growth in labor force participation rate during that time. What are the two big changes that happened? Baby boomers. Baby boomers who were born between 46 and 64 all of a sudden become working age. So if you're born in 46, 64, you're 18 years old, right? And so you can see the baby boom starts taking off. What else? Women. You've had a stage full of women this morning. This has been, that never happens in my field or in the Senate. So this is the women who work in male-dominated fields. Women entered the labor force. So while labor force participation rates went up by 8 percentage points, female labor force participation rates went up by 17 percentage points. Okay. So during this period of time, there's an oversupply of workers. We actually have too many workers. It's hard to find a job in a lot of fields. We had higher unemployment rates than we do now. Right now, there's actually this debate about what is the natural rate of unemployment. Because the rate that many of you saw in your textbooks was better designed for this 1990s period than kind of the current period. Because since then, we've been seeing a persistent decline in labor force participation rates. Now, one of these is because people are living longer. One of the reasons. But the retirement age has not changed very much. My favorite economic fact, that if you ever win Jeopardy with this fact, I get a little portion. Social Security, what's full Social Security, what's the age of full Social Security retirement now?
70.
Okay, I just heard three different answers, which is correct-ish. 67 is full retirement. You can get a little more if you wait till 70. So those of you that said 70, that's right. Some of you said 62. Now, that is early retirement, but you can still pull benefits at 62, and actually a sizable portion of Americans pull benefits at 62. Social Security Act was passed in 1935. What do you think the retirement age was in the bill in 1935?
Maybe 50.
It was 65. It was 65. What was life expectancy?
63.
So, on average, you were supposed to get it for negative 2 years. And now, life expectancy is 80-ish. You can retire at 67, so it's 13 years. You could have indexed it to life expectancy, but we didn't do that. So it went to a program that statistically you weren't supposed to get to one that people rely on for a longer period of time. So that decreases labor force participation rates. This is also why economists don't become politicians, because I could fix that calculation really fast, but it would not get me elected. But there were some other things going on here, too, that are hard things to talk about that you guys are experiencing in your communities. The senator mentioned the opioid bill. There were other things going on, which primarily, if you look at kind of the primary group that has struggled in labor in the past few years, it is mainly prime age, so 25 to 54-year-old white males without a college degree. This is the group that has been hit heaviest by the opioid epidemic. It is the group that in most health services now shows the lowest well-being in society. It is the group that has the most, they're called deaths of despair, which sounds just awful because it is awful. But there's also economic research, very good economic research, that shows that as white males and young males in general, as they have worked less than their parents did, and they are working less, if they work, they're working fewer hours than their parents did, that 75% of that time is spent playing video games, their extra time, which I always think sounds crazy until I look in my own household with my three teenage boys and I have to fight them off, either playing video games or watching videos of other people playing video games, which is so weird to me. So there are real issues going on in terms of labor force participation rates. And I know, because I've interacted with some of you on this, some of you are trying to identify who these folks are in your communities, who are the people that are not in the labor force who can be engaged. I think that's really important work, because the reality is labor is going to get tighter. This is, we've modeled here labor demand and labor supply. So labor demand, worker demand, total number of jobs plus job postings in South Carolina, labor supply, the labor force. And until about 2017, we always had extra workers. So if you're an employer and you've got somebody that's fooling around, not doing a great job, you could let them go, rehire pretty quickly in most sectors. But something started changing around 2017. Around 2017 in the state, and you would see this same pattern nationally, except it started about 2018 nationally. But in about 2017 in South Carolina, all of a sudden worker demand went above the labor force. And if you're not familiar, South Carolina has extremely low labor force participation rates. So if you look nationally, our labor force participation rates are one of the worst in the country. And that has just continued to be the case. So now we have much higher worker demand than we have labor force. And because of the demographic shift, and because we're in a state that does attract a lot of retirees, it is going to be hard for us to raise that labor force participation rate in the state. Not impossible, but it is difficult. So this is probably, in my opinion, unless we have a big decline in labor demand, which none of us want to see a severe recession, so hopefully that doesn't happen. This is going to be an issue for the next few decades. This impacts all sorts of things for employers. And some of you guys are engaged with business or maybe even own businesses where maybe that employee who hadn't been pulling their weight, you've been more hesitant to let go of the past few years because you know it's not that easy to rehire people. And we're starting to see employees kind of, you know, do have more power than they did a few years ago, and I think that will just continue. Let me tell you, though, just really quickly, I didn't put this slide in, but since we are a little ahead of schedule, I'm gonna take the extra time. Every month, there's a stat in the payroll employment report. So if you went to Friday's report and read through it, towards the bottom, you get this interesting statistic. And it's the number of adult Americans who report that they want a job and they're available to work, but they're not working and they're not looking for a job. So I'm gonna say this again. They want a job, they're available to work, but they're not working and they're not looking for a job. And people always giggle when I say that, because I think where a lot of our brains jump to is these are just lazy people who are not getting jobs. And my response to that is always, there are lazy people. There are some in my family. I spend holidays with these people, and it might be why I don't live in Georgia. But so that exists. That exists. But what is more likely and what we know from research is that these are people who are single moms and have three kids and know they can't afford childcare. These are people with a criminal background who have searched for a job for 2 years and gave up. These are people with mental health challenges that have not been helped. These are people that have a disability that doesn't qualify them for SSI, but makes it where they can't stay on their feet for 12 hours a day. So there are all sorts of reasons, what we call non-skill barriers, that keep people on the sidelines. If we want to grow this labor force, we have to address those folks. Because these are the people who are saying, hey, I want to work. Hey, me over here, I want to work. There's just something. There's something kind of in front. And I know a lot of you spend a lot of time thinking about these individuals in your community, but I think that's really important work. So kudos to you guys who are doing that. What we've seen in the past few months is that job openings rates have come down. That's a good thing. This is one of the things that Jerome Powell kept saying. He wanted to see more stability between the supply and demand for labor. This is what he was talking about. The demand for labor was so outrageous that what we were seeing was people were able to just get much higher wages, much higher wages, much higher wages, which puts a ton of pressure on prices, right? If companies have to pay their people more, they're going to charge you more for their goods and services, right? So that has come down, but still well above where we were pre-COVID and very high from like a historical standpoint. But quits and hires have normalized. And this is a good sign. The labor market has calmed down. And so what we've seen that follows this is that producer prices, these are thought of as a leading indicator for consumer prices. Producer prices have normalized. They've come all the way back down to below 2%. But consumer prices have not yet. So this is CPI. This is the inflation rate that you guys would see in the news every month when it comes out. It takes a basket of goods and services. It weights it. So, for example, there would be more weight put on milk and eggs in the basket than there would be on asparagus. Like, it weights it based on how much people buy the product. And they track the prices of these goods and services. It's a very meticulous process every single month. And there's two numbers that come out, what's known as headline CPI, that is the red line, and then there's core CPI, which is the dark blue line. Economists tend to be more interested in core CPI, so let me explain the difference. Core CPI is headline CPI minus direct cost of food and energy. Why do we prefer as economists to take that out to look at prices? There's two reasons. Number one, I want you to notice how volatile that red line is versus the blue line. There are things, energy and food prices are determined mostly in global commodity markets. There are things that can impact the price of oil, for example, OPEC's decision to do X with supply of oil, that don't have anything really to do with inflationary pressures in the current moment. Also, in energy and food markets, there's a lot of hedging. And there are a lot of buy contracts to where current prices don't necessarily, like the price you see in commodity markets today don't actually reflect. Like if you looked at the price of oil today, that does not necessarily reflect what UPS is spending on oil for their trucks and planes because they wrote those contracts in a couple years ago. So that dark blue line actually does a better job showing kind of what current households, current consumers and businesses are facing in terms of inflation. I'll also point out that the price of energy is baked into everything. So when we put the price of asparagus in the core basket, if it costs more to truck the asparagus from point A to point B because gas prices are up, then the asparagus goes up in price. So energy prices are baked in. So we look more at core. We want that number to get down to 2%. And actually, this is the Federal Reserve's preferred measure of inflation, which is called PCE. It's similar to CPI, it's just a little broader. And we look at core PCE. And so when you hear about this 2% inflation target, this is the number. If you want to follow it, you want to follow core PCE. And you'll see on the right-hand side the estimates from the FOMC. So the FOMC is the group of people at the Fed who are voting on interest rate changes. So when you hear the Fed didn't raise interest rates or didn't reduce interest rates, that's the FOMC. The FOMC are the seven board of governors led by Jerome Powell. They work in Washington, D.C. They are government employees. nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate. The FOMC also includes the 12 presidents of the regional Federal Reserve banks. The regional Federal Reserve banks are not a part of the government. I'm not a government employee. Most people think we are. We are not. We work for those banks, so they're independent. So the 12 bank presidents participate with those seven governors. There's 19 people total. 12 voted each meeting. Only five of the presidents vote. They rotate. But every other meeting, they all 19 of them put forward projections of what they think is going to happen in the economy. And so these are their projections for inflation. They did these in December. So at the next meeting in March, the new projections will come out. But I will tell you that these look much more positive than their projections a year ago. Inflation has come down faster than that this group expected. And you can see the kind of the how steep over the last 6 months, let's say, that the decline in core inflation has been. So it's certainly moving in the right direction. I think what we don't know is how hard is it now to get it from 3% to 2%. Sometimes that last mile can be the hardest. And that is now given that supply chains have calmed down, so there's really no more gas we're going to get out of that, or juice we're going to get out of the supply impact, and demand is still very high. So with the type of jobs numbers that we're having, there are some economists, I wouldn't really put myself in this camp, but there are some economists that are worried about kind of a reacceleration of inflation. I'm not too worried about that. What I am, what I do want to point out to folks, though, is that this is not an exact science. We don't know, okay, well, if we reduce interest rates this many times by this month, we know this will happen to inflation. We don't know that. It has to do with all these market forces that are going on. And so there's more art to this. What I do feel very, very confident about is that the FOMC is going to get inflation to the 2% target. They've been very clear about that. If you listen to them talk, there's not a one of them that has waffled on that target. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens with rates this year. This is what's called the dot plot. If you're not familiar with the dot plot, this also comes out every other meeting. And this is where those same 19 people, if you count, there's 18 dots. Somebody doesn't play nice. We don't know who it is that doesn't play nice. It's not our president. I know it's not, but somebody doesn't play nice. So 18 of the 19 estimate where they think interest rates are going to be going forward. And I want to point out to you the difference between just September and December of last year. So in September of last year, the majority of the people on the FOMC thought they were going to raise rates one more time. But they didn't. By December, you can see everybody was in agreement that they hold. And that's because of the data that came in the meantime. And most of the data in terms of inflation was positive during that period of time. But what I really want to point out to you, so these are estimates for the end of each year. What I really want you to look at here is this end of 2025 picture. There was so much uncertainty amongst this group. This is not typical, by the way. Typically, they are much closer bound together, kind of like to 2024 here. But there was so much uncertainty, even amongst this group, which are the best informed economists in the world, in my opinion. There was a lot of uncertainty because of everything going on in the economy. But you can see that even by, there were members of the FOMC that thought rates were going to go up. Somebody thought rates would go up and not be cut until the end of 2025. It's a long time, right? But now at the December meeting, there was one person that still thought they would hold firm. I don't know who this person is, but they're an outlier, right? And we don't know if they're a voting member or not. Our president is a voting member this year. He has not been the past 2 years. But other people are much more tightly bound now. And so you can see that, you know, if you look and kind of read the tea leaves here based on the median response, you can see that this is kind of projecting there will be three rate cuts in 2024. But I also want to point out to you how much it changed just in a three-month period. This is such a fluid process. The way we inform our president, the way we talk about things, the way we look at data. The Federal Reserve has access, as you can imagine, to a tremendous treasure trove of data. And so this looks like this today, but if inflation picked back up, it could look different in March. If inflation continues to go down, I think it will look different as well. So it's a fluid situation. But if you look at the longer run view, which is the far right on both, you'll see that the longer run view on interest rates has remained the same, basically. That kind of the neutral rate or the rate that will keep us at 2% inflation is about 2.5%. So where does the economy go from here? Like I said, growth for 2023 far outpaced expectations that most people had. So what does 2024 look like? Most people are predicting kind of flat growth this year. So I don't think we really know. We got a stronger than expected January's jobs report. So far Q1 looks pretty good. Holiday spending came in higher than expected. So far things look good, but there are potential speed bumps and things like the government shutdown, which it still looms out there because they haven't permanently fixed that. The election is a big one. If there was all the sudden inflation that exceeded expectations, if we got a big bounce up in inflation, that would be something to look for. And then still this expiration of pandemic era benefits. There still is a lot of money kind of circulating through the system that's left over from that stimulus. But I would be remiss if I didn't point out that when you look at that consumer spending that's going up, 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 that is being driven by high-income individuals, consumer consumption going up. Low-income families have pulled back. They have to. If you live paycheck to paycheck and inflation and prices go up 9.1% in 1 month, you have to pull back unless you have excess resources, right? And since that excess spending has been spent down for lower-income families, they absolutely have pulled back. We also hear from grocery stores and other retailers that people, lower-income consumers, have been substituting down. So, for example, instead of buying name-brand Honey Nut Cheerios, they're buying the store brand. Or instead of buying 93% lean ground beef, they're buying 85%. They're substituting down. So very important to pay attention to those households. I think it's still unknown. If in the end it turns out that the Fed raised rates as much as it did and it did not impact consumers, this is going to be a first. This is not what one would have predicted. But we were in this interesting time where interest rates had been so low for so long that almost everybody in this room is locked into very low interest rate debt still. Many of you have mortgage rates that are in the 2 and 3%. Many of you bought cars with very low interest rates. And so even though interest rates have gone up a lot, those haven't necessarily hit households in the same way because people haven't moved, right? I mean, we've seen that in the data. There's a shortage of existing homes for sale in the market because people, it really hit me as an economist this past year that the house I live in Rock Hill, South Carolina, that I've lived in for 15 years, I could not afford it at today's interest rates and prices. I could not afford my own house that I bought 15 years ago. That's not how it normally works, right? Normally 15 years after buying a house, you could afford way more than what you currently live in. This is a really unique time. And so some of these economic indicators not going the way we would expect really is not so surprising if you just think about how unique this period of time has been. Makes it really hard to forecast for economists because economists in forecasting models use historical data. So I would take every forecast with a very large grain of salt. But it is a super dynamic, interesting time. And there are going to continue to be winners and losers in all of this. The Carolinas as a whole, in my opinion, will absolutely be winners. South Carolina will absolutely be a winner. There are going to be communities in South Carolina that continue to lose people and talent. And so as a state, as an institution, you guys are going to have to think about how to support those communities because there will be people that have very deep ties to those communities that want to remain in place, right? So everybody moving to Charleston is just not an answer, and the people here from Charleston don't want that to be the answer, right? But there's got to be supports for those communities as well. So I think we have some time to take questions. Happy to take questions on anything. Yeah.
How do you see credit card debt?
Yeah, great question. Credit card debt. So credit card debt is super interesting. And if you shoot me an email, I can send you this picture. But credit card debt is at an all-time high. It hit $1 trillion this year, which makes for a really good news headline. So it was out everywhere. We look at this very closely. Interestingly, though, if you adjust for inflation and income, it's just back to where it was before COVID. So it actually hasn't increased. What happened during COVID is a lot of people took that excess savings and that stimulus and paid down their credit card debt. So for a period of time, we had much lower credit card debt per capita, per dollar of income than we typically have. So it's just now back to 2019 levels, and it's still way, way below where we were before the Great Recession. So it is increasing, but from like a overall economic, like it hasn't gotten to the point yet where we are concerned about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to give you my first answer, which is this is why I'm so glad. He asked about the deficit, the national deficit. This is why I'm so glad I don't work for the government. And I'm not a federal government employee. Okay, I'm going to give you my opinion as an economist. So my Fed answer is that the Federal Reserve can't do anything about that. And I've heard our president get asked this question, and I really liked the way he answers it, which is that when they're doing this monetary policy, they have to conduct, there's monetary policy that's done by the Fed, then there's fiscal policy that's done by the Congress and the president, right? The Senate, House of Representatives, Senate and president. When they're conducting monetary policy, they just have to assume fiscal policy is status quo. So their assumptions have to be that the debt will continue to grow, because they can't do anything to change that. Now, clearly, if we would do certain things on fiscal side, it would make doing monetary policy easier, and you would have to rely less on monetary policy. But what do you do to pull, what do you do if you have inflation on the fiscal policy side? You raise taxes, you cut spending. Good luck. Right? Good luck. And so people in the United States, does not matter your party, have what we call, and this is now my economist answer, expansionary bias, which means we love, I mean, I was trained as a state and local tax economist. My personal belief is if we want to consume like we do, if we want to have Social Security now that lasts for 13 years, we have to tax ourselves more. That is very unpopular politically. And also, I'm also an American consumer. So if there's a tax rebate and they send me a check in the mail, I am depositing that check right away into my account. Right? People love a tax cut. They love a tax rebate. They love spending. People do not like a tax increase. They do not like cuts. They say they like cuts, but then you say, oh, well, would you cut this? No. Would you cut that? No. So I think from my own personal view as an economist, if we want to consume like we do, we should tax ourselves more. If we don't want to tax ourselves more, we should cut the way we consume. Raise Social Security age by 10 years or something like that. But that's politically unpopular. So unfortunately, we have to rely more on the monetary policy side. And this has really been going. If you study, another one of my favorite facts is 1940s, we go into World War II. We know we're going to spend a ton of money. What did the government do? They raised the top marginal tax rate to 93%. So if you made over the equivalent now of about $3 million a year, you paid 93 cents on the dollar to the federal government. Why did they do that? Well, if you're active duty military and you're deployed, you don't pay that. If you were in the U.S. and lucky enough to be making money, you were going to pay down the debt. People bought war bonds. It was a thing, right? Those rates, that top marginal rate, stayed at 93% until 1962, until we paid down the debt. And then we did it several times. If you look at tax rates, kind of how we did it. And then that started changing really in the 1980s. We just don't do it anymore. So, it's as a tax economist, is something I'm really, really interested in. But I also realize like the politics of it. It's easy for me to stand up here and say that, and harder for the senators to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the fact that keeping your own home gives you
yeah. Yeah.
Many of our cities, we are all experiencing unattainable housing.
Yes. Absolutely.
Where is our economy going to benefit the communities and these people?
Great question. So this is about the how housing is unattainable. I mean, I worry about this for my own children, right? I've got a son that's about to graduate college, and who knows? I mean, he can't live with me, but I don't know where he's going, but he's got to go somewhere. This is a huge issue. This is a tremendous issue, and it's not just for low-income families, right? This is a huge issue for everyone, except for those that have very high incomes. And once again, these are hard conversations because people say they are really pro-affordable housing until somebody tries to build an affordable housing complex near where they live, and then NIMBYism becomes rampant. I think there are ways in which local governments, you guys, can improve the efficiency of the permitting process to make it where people that do want to build things affordably can do it cheaper and faster. I think you guys have a role in that. And this comes from lots of conversations we have with people. I think also, as a society, we have to decide that this is an important issue and that you might have to have something built near your home that's not exactly what you would have preferred. I also think in the South, one of the important conversations we're going to have is about density. We don't like to build up. In the South, we all like to have these big yards and things like that, but with the number of people we have moving here, we're just simply not going to be able to do that without people just having insane commutes. And so I think density plays a huge role, and I think making the process of making it cheaper and more accessible to build affordable, and when I say affordable housing, I don't just mean affordable housing. I mean housing that is affordable for people and communities. The other thing we are hearing from developers, and by the way, home builders had record years last year. If you had a lot and you could build a house on it, you sold it. The problem is having the lot, getting it ready, and right? But we are hearing that people are choosing much smaller homes. So this is gonna be interesting too for generations, and really it kind of fits that labor force story I was telling. For generations, almost everybody in here lives in a bigger house than your parents did. And your parents live in a bigger house than your grandparents did, that's going to change with this generation. There's going to be a shift back, and that's a tough adjustment. People thought their starter home was going to have granite countertops and four bedrooms and a bonus room. That's not going to be what it is. So we are hearing, and we can see it in the data too, that the average square foot of a home is shrinking. People are going to live in smaller townhomes, things like that. Things we aren't really used to seeing in the South, right? It's not as typical for people to live, families to live in condos or townhomes. We're going to see more of that. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the cryptocurrency and also the
executive
order that the president has made?
Yeah, I don't know about a banning of cryptocurrency. I don't know about that, so I won't comment on that. But cryptocurrency, I do get asked a lot about that. We actually don't talk about it too much at the Fed because it is so far outside of we can't regulate it. Cryptocurrency, I think, plays a role, especially in countries. I myself have done a lot of work in Bolivia and South America, which has very unstable monetary policy, very unstable currency, and so it can really help in places like that. So I do think there's a role for it, but it's actually not something we talk a ton about at the Fed because really the vast majority of transactions are still done in dollars. Like, what does the world look like 50 years from now? I think it's very hard to tell, but we talk about it a lot less, or at least in my part of the Fed. I'm sure there's parts of the Fed that talk about it a lot, but the ETFs that came out are just show a greater, and they got approved. It's showing a greater and greater acceptance of this, right? I mean, 10 years ago, probably most of you in this room had never heard of Bitcoin, and now pretty much people don't know how it works necessarily, but they at least know what it is. And so there certainly is a greater acceptance of it. Local level? She was asking how accurate the data are on a local level. I love this question. Not as accurate as we want it to be. That's why I talk a lot about like MSAs, because there is really good data on MSAs. So MSAs are metropolitan statistical areas. So it's like the county the big city is in and then the surrounding counties that people commute from, basically, is how they're put together. County level data can be decent. When you get below that and you start looking at towns and cities, it's very difficult. And the reason for that is all this data is gained from surveys. And so if they survey, let's say 60,000 people, that's a lot, but like how many of them are from Conway? Like two people, right? So we can't rely on that data. So we have to be a little more creative. There is good data that comes out with a lag. So with data at like the zip code level or the city level, we just have to wait a much longer time to get some of that. And still some of it is not as good as we wish it were. So unfortunately, it's hard to get some of that data. But at the county level, at the MSA level, you can get some better data.
Could you comment about the impact of student loan burden?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so student loans, this is a really interesting one, and now that I have children in college, one that is important to me. So student loan payments have restarted, but there's no penalty if you don't pay within the first year, which means a lot of people have not restarted yet. So I think the number is 40% have restarted payment at this point. So I don't think we know exactly what's going to happen, but a couple things with student loans. Number one, the majority of student loan borrowers don't owe all that much. The borrowers. The majority of the dollars borrowed are borrowed by high-income households. So if you look at, I do higher ed research, so I've looked at this data. If you sort academic programs by student loan balances, the highest are dental programs, veterinary programs, law schools, med school. So there's dental programs in the United States where the average person comes out with over $350,000 in student loan debt. So if you compare that to like somebody who took out $15,000 in undergrad, right, it makes up a big percentage. The lower income borrowers who typically have smaller amounts, the government, the Biden administration was able through executive order, well, through changes in the Department of Education to change the repayment plans for those individuals. So you used to pay 5% of your income, now you pay 10%, now you pay 5%. And over a period of time, it's eventually forgiven. So the terms have been made much better for a lot of Americans on their student loans. But they haven't been made better for the people that owe a lot of money that are doctors, lawyers, vets, whatever. College tuition rates have grown much faster than inflation. It is completely out of control. If you guys don't know, in the state of South Carolina, the cost of attendance in-state for the big state universities is over $35,000. Very few families can afford that, right? So that is problematic. There's a whole host of reasons why that's happened, mainly that the percentage of the budget of these schools provided by the state was cut dramatically in the Great Recession and never fully came back. So there's all sorts of things going on that make college expensive. But I'll also tell you this. It's really interesting. So my son is studying abroad in England right now. And him being in England is saving us $5,000 this semester. And the $5,000, so people think we've sent him on this exotic trip. I'm like, I'm an economist. My husband's an accountant. Like, we're saving money. The $5,000 that he is saving is in room and board costs. So he was telling me about the cafeteria at this university, big university in England. You know how many choices there are? Three. One is vegan. He's not a vegan. He has two choices. That's it. His cafeteria at his college back home, there are like 1,000 choices. So some of this too, you know, it makes me think sometimes like, what are we, you know, the standards we're setting for these college students? Do we really need these big fancy? Do they need to live in a dorm room that looks like an apartment? I was fine in a cinder block room. I mean, it was fine. So some of this is cultural too. We could change some of this. But yeah, him being over there, you know, he said to me on the phone, he said, you know, now that I'm here, I wonder why they give me so many choices at school. You don't give me any choices. I'm like, good point. Good point. Uh-huh. Yeah, she's asking about people like selling their homes and buying RVs or going and living. You know, I think one of the things, one of the stats I like to point out is that 49% of Gen Z, so the Gen Z generation is now, I guess, 28 and younger. 49% of that generation never expects to own a home. It's by far the highest percentage we've ever seen in that statistic. Now, that doesn't mean their minds won't change. As they get older, it might change. But what it does mean is they are consuming today as though they will never buy a home, right? So if you ask a 24-year-old, like, oh, are you saving for a down payment? They're probably going to look at you a little funny, right? Whereas in my generation, it would have been a normal question. So I think people are consuming differently. There is definitely a thing out there where people are valuing experiences and just going and doing and... But so I'm really curious as an economist, like, where does this go? Are is there a period of time where more people say, no, I want to own a home? Or is this the generation that says, no, we're going to embrace kind of more rental culture, which, by the way, they have all over Europe. It's not like we're, you know, other developed nations have things like this, but are they going to be the ones to embrace density, for example? It's going to be really interesting to see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm afraid our
okay.
time is
out. Sorry.
We have
it's her
so,
after.
So appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah,
sorry.
Thank you so
absolutely.
Much.
Thank you.